came from my interest in the Bible because of the kind of light that the Dead Sea Scrolls shed on what's known as the intertestamental period, sometimes referred to as Second Temple Judaism, because it's the period during which the second Jewish temple was standing in Jerusalem. The first temple, of course, was built by King Solomon many years before. The Jews went into Babylonian exile. They came back from Babylon. They rebuilt the temple. And they eventually rebuilt Jerusalem under the leadership of Ezra and Nehemiah. And that temple stood for 400 or 500 years until Jesus Christ came on the scene. And King Herod did some additions and augmentations to the second temple, but it was still the same temple around that Jesus entered, that he even cleansed a couple of times. Remember that scene from the Gospels where Jesus actually flies into a rage and says, it is written, my house should be a house of prayer for all nations, but you have made it a den of thieves. That was the second temple that he was in. So we refer to this whole period for that reason as Second Temple Judaism. Now, there's a couple other terms I'll define for you here as we get going. But to introduce the topic, I've got a video clip I want to show you. And I've got a couple other video clips that I'll show throughout the presentation. And I show these because it really, better than I could do describing it in words, it makes the scene of the Middle East, and specifically the area around the Dead Sea Scrolls, called Qumran, come alive. All right, so we'll start with that, and then I'll intersperse the video clips with explanations that sort of immerse us deeper and deeper into the world of the Bible and the world of Jesus. So with that, without further ado, let's start this. And somebody holler if it's too loud or it's not loud enough.
On the desolate shores of the Dead Sea, 200 years before the birth of Christ, a group of men known as the Sons of Light lived in a biblical community. They preserved their beliefs and visions in a great library of scrolls.
They shall separate from the habitation of unjust men, and shall go into the wilderness to prepare there the way of Him.
Aligning themselves with heaven over a period of 200 years, they prepared for the end of days, a last great battle between the forces of light and the forces of darkness. When the victorious Roman army retreated, the voices and visions of Qumran were lost. For 2,000 years, dust blew over the graves of the Sons of Light, who remained forgotten.
Scholars at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem undertake the painstaking work of piecing together bits of ancient biblical scrolls found in a mountain cave near the Dead Sea. This parchment document.
It was a simple Bedouin boy who stumbled across what has been called the most important archaeological find of the 20th century. From the discovery of the first scroll, hope and fear ran high. Hope that the scrolls would reveal eyewitness accounts from the very days of Jesus' life in Palestine. Fear that they would undermine the fundamental beliefs of Christianity and Judaism. The story of the discovery and scholarship of the scrolls has often been shrouded in secrecy. Hidden documents, false accusations, and conspiracy theories involving governments and world leaders. What else is hidden in the desert? Now on the threshold of a new millennium, scientists and scholars using the most sophisticated space-age technology are adding their voices to the ancient search for meaning buried with the Dead Sea Scrolls. They come from all over the world to unlock the truth about the Sons of Light. The academic controversies of the early 90s obscured the real mystery of the scrolls, of who wrote them, and why they were hidden deep in caves along the Dead Sea. What is clear is that the scrolls were carefully hidden in sealed jars. Were they hidden in a panic to be recovered after some danger had passed? Or were they placed there over a period of time for the benefit of future generations? Clues to this mystery are hidden in fragments of the past that scholars and scientists have labored over for half a century. Stephen Fahn of the Center for the Study of Early Christianity in Jerusalem is working towards the synthesis of science, scholarship, and archaeology at Qumran.
What we're doing is we're returning to the scene of the crime to solve the mystery. We come back to the place where the events took place here at Qumran and study the place in context. We study the actual documents these people had in their hands and interrelate them to the site and the events that took place there. And we consult the witnesses, the eyewitnesses that knew these people and spoke in detail about them at the time in which they lived.
Magan Broshi, archaeologist and former curator of the Shrine of the Book in Jerusalem, has led many teams over the years that have carried out excavations at Qumran.
The Dead Sea Scrolls have been discovered in 11 caves. Those caves are geologically of two kinds. Five of the caves are in the cliffs, in the very hard limestone, in the Dolomites, and they are, of course, natural caves. The other six caves are artificial caves which have been dug in the soft marl. The artificial caves are the best solution to survive in this very, very harsh climate. And it is very easy to dig. You see, this is the marl. It crumbles in your hands. So it doesn't require very hard labor. On the floor, we found hundreds of punctures, which testified that the place was occupied.
The Dead Sea Scrolls is an expansive collection of over 800 manuscripts. 50 years of unparalleled scholarship has opened this ancient library to the modern world. But there is still much debate over the origin of this large body of work. Was it the product of the Sons of Light themselves, living and writing in this secluded desert community? Or was it authored somewhere else and brought to Qumran later by men who fled from the catacombs of Jerusalem? In the early 1950s, a few scholars in Jerusalem began the task of reassembling this library from tens of thousands of disintegrated fragments. Some of the fragments were smaller than the tip of a finger, and other fragments were blackened and hardened with the passage of time. The task was overwhelming and frustrating to scholars, a tedious and groundbreaking work that was fueled by the rising expectations among academics, religious leaders, and the public at large.
Scholars and the general public alike were hoping to find glimpses, or much more than glimpses, of Jesus and early Christianity in the scrolls.
This great expectation was met with frustration, as the process of scholarship was painstaking and initially limited to 8 scholars, all Christians and no Jews. The foundation was laid for widespread suspicions of a religious cover-up. The established churches had much to lose if the scrolls contained information from the days of Jesus which undermined age-long beliefs. Piecing thousands of fragments together, early research would soon present evidence of a desert community. The 800 manuscripts left by the community comprise 3 distinct groups of literature. The first group contains the entire Hebrew Bible, save the Book of Esther. These are the oldest copies of Old Testament texts by 1,000 years. The second part of the library are texts that were part of the literary heritage of the period. The last group is the sectarian scrolls that describe the life and teachings of the Sons of Light as they lived in the desert. But scholars still had doubts about the authenticity of the scrolls found. A new method of determining the age of artifacts, carbon-14 analysis, had just been introduced in the 1950s, but was dismissed as too clumsy a technique to apply to the precious scrolls. The scholars instead focused on another method of dating the scrolls.
Paleography is, I guess, literally the study of old writing. Concretely, it's the study of old writing with the end of the goal of dating the material. Because scripts change over time, like all artifacts, whether it's cars or dresses or musical styles or whatever, each letter in an alphabet changes steadily and not at the same rate, so that you're able to examine where each of the letters is in a given alphabet, and that gives you the basis for an absolute date, or at least a relative date in your typological sequence.
The early paleographical dating performed by Frank Cross on the Dead Sea Scrolls has later been confirmed by more sophisticated and less invasive carbon-14 dating. The scrolls had indeed been written in the cradle of Christianity and Rabbinic Judaism. The oldest texts are from 250 to 150 BCE, but the bulk of the material, most of it relating to the life of the people at Qumran, is written between 100 BCE and 70 CE. No texts have been found that are younger than 70 CE, indicating that this is the time when the scrolls were hidden in the caves.
All right, so hopefully that gives you a good introduction to the topic. Now, there's a couple of explanations of things in this film that I need to make clear before we go any further. One of them is the guy's talking about something called CE and BCE, just in case you're not familiar with those terms. They stand for Common Era, which is another way of saying AD. So the year 70 CE is the year 70 AD, okay? And BCE stands for Before Common Era, which is the same as BC, so 100 BCE is the same as 100 before Christ, okay? The reason they do that is because there's this trend in academia of getting away from terminology that seemed to be too Christian. So like AD and BC are Christian terms, right? AD stands for Anno Domini, which stands for the year of our Lord. And who's our Lord? Jesus Christ. So in modern secular scholarship, people sort of want to get away from that. In Judaism, they also want to get away from it as well, not because they're secular, but because they're not Christian, and so they want to move toward more neutral terminology. So maybe you already knew that. I don't want to insult anybody's intelligence, but especially some of the younger folks may not be aware of this. Also, a term you need to be aware of as we go through this is the term Rabbinic Judaism. What this normally is used to refer to is Judaism after Christ. More specifically, Judaism after the Jewish temple was destroyed by the Romans in 70 AD. The reason that term arose is because once the temple was destroyed in 70 AD, the leadership of the temple, namely the Levitical priests, went away. Because if there's no temple, there's no priesthood associated with the temple. And leadership of Jewish religion consolidated around the group of the Pharisees, which is discussed in the New Testament. And the Pharisaic rabbis became the leaders of Judaism. Again, we'll get into this in more detail, so you get a better feel for how these guys were operating at the time of Jesus and at the time of the Dead Sea Scrolls, because it's really important context for understanding the Dead Sea Scrolls, and the scrolls indeed talk about this larger geopolitical religious setting in which they were composed and used at this community at Qumran. All right, so that's the preliminaries. Now, the Hebrew word for community, which is pronounced Yahad, is commonly used to refer to this group of individuals out in the desert because they really genuinely believe themselves to be a covenantal community living under the true spirit of the laws of Moses and of the wider culture of Judaism that God intended when he brought the Hebrew nation into existence. They tended to organize themselves in the Judean desert around 200 to 150 BC, and I'll tell you in a minute how we know that. But as he says in the clip, they were most active between 100 BC and 70 AD when the temple was destroyed, except for the reign of Herod the Great. The archaeological evidence seems to show that the site was abandoned, at least the Qumran site was abandoned, around 37 BC, which is when Herod the Great came to power. And they didn't return until a few years after the birth of Jesus, or at least a little time after the birth of Jesus, if it wasn't measured in years, when Herod the Great died. Now, you may remember in the Gospels, when Jesus is born, Joseph gets this message from an angel that he needs to go to Egypt because Herod was going to try to kill the baby Jesus. So Joseph and Mary and Jesus go down to Egypt and they wait until Herod dies. He comes back. They come back as soon as Herod has passed away. And Herod's son is now reigning in Jerusalem. But this fact that this group of Messianic Jews in the Judean wilderness departed in much the same way that Jesus did is very interesting. I don't know yet, I'm still reading up on this a little bit. I don't know all the knowledge that's out there regarding this period that the site appears to have been abandoned, why they did that. But I suspect it had something to do with the fact that this group awaited a final apocalyptic battle between the forces of light and the forces of darkness, with the forces of light led by the Messiah, whoever that was going to be. And again, I'll get into why they believe this from the Old Testament here in a few minutes. But the discovery of this Yahad, this community, was a worldwide phenomenon. And the scrolls were initially discovered in 1947 when just a simple Bedouin shepherd boy took a rock and threw it into one of the caves at Qumran and heard a plink. The rock hit something. It made a plinking sound that was not the sound of a rock hitting the ground or hitting more rock. And he crawled into the cave, and lo and behold, there's these jars, these clay jars, that are turned out were full of Hebrew scripture. Not just Hebrew, Aramaic as well. There are even a few Greek manuscripts in this collection. The film gives the numbers about 800. That clip I showed you was made in 1998. Today, there's more than 900 documents that have been recovered from Qumran, and that means 900 different documents represented by fragments and scraps that number in the thousands, if you follow me. Those scraps have to be pieced together by various means that I'll show you here in a minute how they do that. And so far, those scraps have identified some 900 documents, with the number still climbing. Now, of those 900, only about 200 to 250 are copies of biblical books. I mean, a lot of people, when they hear about the Dead Sea Scrolls, they think they're only copies of biblical books. They're just really old manuscripts of the Bible, which they do include, but they're also very much more than that, as that video clip hinted at. It is possible, just kind of a side note, it's possible that some of those documents were not, in fact, used at Qumran, but were from other Judean desert sites that when the Romans advanced on Judea and the Jews kind of figured out, okay, something bad is about to happen, they hid these documents from other sites in Qumran because Qumran is one of the closest sites to Jerusalem among all these sites that this Yahad was using, or these various groups of Yahad-like people were using in the Judean desert. All right, so that's just a little bit of a setup for you. Now, in addition, I want to tell you the modern institutions that have been involved in scholarship on the Dead Sea Scrolls, and they include, probably most importantly, the Israeli Antiquities Authority, because the IAA is the governmental body in Israel that has authority over every archaeological find in the state of Israel. The scrolls were first uncovered in 1947, as I mentioned. The first cave was uncovered in 1947. The other 10 caves, out of the known 11 caves, were progressively discovered between 1947 and the mid-1950s, 1954, 1955. Now, as you may recall, the State of Israel was established in 1948 after the initial discovery. So from the time that they were discovered in 1947 until the Jews took actual power in Palestine, the Jordanian government was the authority that was in charge of the area of the West Bank where all of this took place. It includes Jerusalem, includes the Qumran site, includes all of the West, or most of the West Bank of the Dead Sea. The Jordanians, like many of the surrounding Arab nations in the Middle East, have a healthy dose of anti-Semitism, that they harbored towards the Jews, and that's why there were no Jewish scholars in that initial group of scholars that the film clip mentioned. The Jordanian government assigned what they saw to be respectable, reputable scholars who would investigate the scrolls from a non-biased point of view, whatever that meant to them. And it turned out that that created a lot of controversy and politics, and some of these scrolls didn't end up getting published until 30 years after they were discovered. That story is a story by itself, and many books have been written on this. But the bottom line is that people could make academic careers built on the Dead Sea Scrolls, and so they tended to sort of hoard control over these valuable manuscripts, and the manuscripts themselves are worth millions and millions of dollars. And that, as you can imagine, people being like they are, right, led to a whole bunch of distrust and backstabbings and political intrigues like you wouldn't believe. Like I say, entire stories have been written on this. So in any case, the Jews eventually took control in Palestine, with the IAA being the specific governmental body charged with managing these archaeological discoveries and others in Israel. The Hebrew University in Jerusalem is a key institution in this whole story, specifically a man named Emmanuel Tov, who you heard from in the clip, who's one of the most reputable, if not the most reputable person working on the Dead Sea Scrolls. Pretty much anything with his name on it is taken with a huge amount of legitimacy and respect in the world of Dead Sea Scrolls scholarship, and for that matter, in scholarship around the Hebrew Bible in general. Brigham Young University played a role in this, as you'll see. The NASA Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California, even got involved in this. And you'll see some of the technology they applied to the Dead Sea Scrolls, which is really, really mind-blowing. A guy at NYU, or you saw Frank Moore Cross from Harvard University. Cross passed away 2 or 3 years ago. When he was still alive, he was, like Tov, one of the major players in the world of biblical archaeology and biblical scholarship in terms of the Old Testament. Same with Lawrence Schiffman from NYU. I'm going to show you a clip of Schiffman here in a minute. And Schiffman is, from a Jewish standpoint, he's a Jewish rabbi, or at least a Jewish scholar of rabbinic Judaism. He's going to say some things about the scrolls that are extremely interesting from a Jewish standpoint. So he's not a Christian Jew. He's a non-believing Jew. And so hearing what he says about the scrolls is very, very helpful in many ways for understanding how Jews see these things. There were other major universities and centers in the U.S. and Europe that were involved, as well as some independent scholars who may have been associated with various institutions, but were not part of that establishment group that started the early scholarship on the scrolls. All right, so I think that's enough about the institutions. Now, just a word about the biblical manuscripts I mentioned a minute ago. You may or may not know this, but all modern Old Testaments, by which I mean Old Testaments in versions of the Bible that post-date the Old King James and the Geneva Bible and those various early English translations of the Bible from the 17th century, I'm talking about the 20th century versions, the New American Standard, the New King James, the ESV, the NIV, any modern translation, whatever translation you use, has an Old Testament that is based on a manuscript that's known as the Leningrad Codex. It was copied in the year 1008 or thereabouts AD, and it is the oldest known complete copy of the Old Testament, or the Hebrew Bible. Hebrew Bible and Old Testament mean the same thing. There's also something called the Aleppo Codex, which a lot of people have heard of. It's a little older than Leningrad, but it's incomplete. It has a few books missing. Now, this codex is housed in Leningrad. That's why it's named like it is. And scholars who develop copies of the Hebrew Bible that English translations are then based upon use this manuscript with other manuscripts like the Aleppo Codex and the Septuagint, which is a Greek translation of the Old Testament, and other ancient sources to put together the best, what they call, critical copy of the text so that any errors that may have crept in any one particular manuscript can be canceled out by the general witness of the total body of Old Testament manuscripts that we have. So that just gives you a little flavor for how modern Old Testaments come into existence. Yes, sir?
If you're giving me information that I haven't heard before, where does the Masoretic text fit into this?
Excellent question. The Hebrew text, the Masoretic text is not a manuscript. It is a body of Hebrew text that the Leningrad Codex and the Aleppo Codex and other Hebrew manuscripts like it contain. So when people refer to the Masoretic text, they're referring to the Hebrew Masoretes, who were ancient scribes who worked out of the area of northern Israel, specifically a city called Tiberias that's right on the shore of the Sea of Galilee, if you recall the geography of the Holy Land, in the Middle Ages, about this time. In fact, one of the major schools of the Masoretes was known as the Ben Asher School, and the Ben Asher School copied the Leningrad Codex. So does that make sense? I mean, when you talk about a specific manuscript, you're talking about one piece of leather with writing on it, and the text that it contains may or may not be Masoretic. Okay? Now, most Hebrew opinion consolidated around the Masoretic text during the Middle Ages. So most manuscripts we have today contain the Masoretic text. There are a few sort of other texts that don't contain the Masoretic. They sort of got scribal alterations and different scribal traditions and copying habits and this sort of thing that distinguish them from the Masoretic text. Sometimes people will use the Masoretic text to refer to the Hebrew as opposed to the Septuagint, which is Greek. Okay, so there's different ways in which that term is used, but don't want to like overwhelm. If this is new to everybody and you didn't catch all that, don't worry. That's additional blessing that you got for free. You can think about it that way. All right. Now, the manuscripts that were found at Qumran, here's the key point, are 1,000 years older than Leningrad and Aleppo. Now, that's a lot, right? I mean, the Leningrad is 1,000 years older than us, and the Dead Sea Scrolls are 1,000 years older than that. So what this did for people who are technical scholars of the Bible, worried about things like what the Masoretes did and didn't do and that sort of thing, are getting in a really detailed nuts and bolts fashion, working with the Hebrew text of the Old Testament, need as much evidence as they can to try to reconstruct what the most likely original reading was. Okay. However, the Dead Sea Scrolls did substantially confirm what's contained in Leningrad and Aleppo. And when we talk about differences, we're talking about, you know, things in the 95th, 96th, 98th percentile of what may be different. So the text that's in your Old Testament did not change as a result of the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls, if you follow what I'm saying. The film talked about, you know, a whole bunch of worry about that sort of thing. I don't get the impression that, you know, normal Christians like us in normal churches like this were really all that worried that the Dead Sea Scrolls would undermine what we thought the Bible said. I just don't get that. That seems to be more of an academic concern than a concern of Christians on the ground, if you know what I mean. Scholars are sort of really neurotic about, you know, new discoveries and what's it gonna prove wrong that we thought we knew and all this sort of stuff. But I mean, the number of copies that we have of the Old Testament measures in the hundreds. And the number of copies we have of the New Testament measures in the thousands, easily. And new copies of the New Testament are discovered every year. New copies. New manuscripts that were like buried under some stack of rubble somewhere when some invading army destroyed a city and this sort of thing. And so, especially in the 19th century when archaeology of the Middle East really took off in a big way, copies of the New Testament that are in existence accumulated in number at a rapid pace. So discovering a few hundred more is more important in the terms of the Old Testament than it is in terms of the New Testament, but still not a huge impact in terms of, you know, normal Christians reading their Old Testament. You know what I'm saying? I mean, there's a distinction here between what scholars worry about and concern themselves with, and what real people, real Christians, are concerned with and worried about. And me personally, because I'm, you know, in academia right now, I try to stay tuned into these differences, because otherwise, you know, the academy turns into sort of an ivory tower that's out of touch with the real world, right? I'll give you a couple more examples of this as we go through this, because it's important for maintaining healthy perspective. As I mentioned, there's also the Septuagint was also discovered among the Dead Sea Scrolls. Same situation as with the Hebrew. Some scribal differences, but not anything major or earth-shaking in terms of what we thought the Bible said before that. All right. Do I have a clip next? No, one more slide. Second Temple Judaism, I explained to you before, so I won't go through that again. This is important, though, for understanding the continuum of Jewish thought in the Second Temple period. You'll recognize these groups, the Sadducees and the Pharisees, because Jesus interacts with them a lot in the New Testament. The apostles interact with them a lot in the New Testament. John the Baptist interacts with them as well. So these are major players in the story of Jesus. There's also this group, though, that was known as the Essenes, sometimes also called Zealots. And Jesus has a disciple named Simon the Zealot, if you recall. He's one of the 12. I think, there's not unanimity of opinion on this, I think these two groups of people are really one group. They're essentially the same folks referred to by different names. Some people think they're two different groups, like the Essenes are one group, and there's this other group called the Zealots. But if you really dig down into why they think they're different, it gets into a little, like I said before, a little bit overly academic, sort of hair-splitting kind of discussion. Really, for most intents and purposes, there's three main groups to be aware of in the Second Temple period. The Sadducees, the Pharisees, and the Essenes, also known as the Zealots. There's another group in the New Testament called the Herodians, who seem to have been more like people who align themselves with King Herod because he was in power, and people like to be aligned with whoever's in power. They didn't really have any religious convictions that identified these groups, but they just, you know, they supported Herod's rule, which was controversial because Herod was not Jewish. Not many people know that, but Herod was not Jewish. He had been appointed by the Romans. So the Jews viewed him as an imposter. And one of the reasons why Herod is so neurotic about his title as king of the Jews, and why when the wise men come to him and say, "Where is he who has been born king of the Jews, that we might go and worship him?" Herod goes, "I don't like the sound of that." And he tells the wise men, "You know, tell me where you find him so that I can come and worship him too." Right? Having completely other motives. And when he figures out that the wise men kind of dissed him on that, he slaughters all of the babies in and around Bethlehem under 2 years of age. You remember that episode in the Gospels called the Slaughter of the Innocents, or the Massacre of the Innocents. Very sad story in biblical history and in Jewish history. But the Sadducees, just to sort of wrap this up, the Sadducees were mainly wealthy, high priestly, and priestly classes who had, because of their wealth and power in Israel, become secularized. The New Testament says they didn't believe in resurrection, for example. And why do you, if you're a Jewish priest, why do you stop believing in resurrection, given passages like the Valley of the Dry Bones in Ezekiel, where the Lord shows Ezekiel this valley full of dry bones, and the Lord tells Ezekiel to prophesy to the dry bones, and the dry bones come to life right there before his eyes, right? What is that symbolizing but resurrection? The Valley of the Dry Bones is a story of resurrection, prophecy of resurrection. And every Jew knew Ezekiel and knew what was in Ezekiel, at least in a general way. So a lot of the popular Jewish sentiment was opposed to the Sadducees because they read their Bibles and were like, why do these guys not believe in resurrection? However, the Sadducees were priests, and the Jewish priesthood is hereditary, remember, so descended from the Levites. But the high priest descended from Aaron, specifically. So these guys developed a lot of power and wealth over the years in Israel and became sort of these modern skeptics, not unlike secular academics that occupy many of our universities and many of our churches, for that matter, today. Acts 5:17 is a relevant verse. It says, "Then the high priest rose up and all those who were with him," open parentheses, "which is the sect of the Sadducees." So that's what I mean when the New Testament talks about this group. The name is drawn from the high priest, Zadok, who was the first high priest in Solomon's temple. That's where the name Sadducee comes from. It's a Greek form of the Hebrew name Zadok. Actually, Zadok is probably the proper Hebrew pronunciation. The New Testament, as I said, says that they disbelieved in resurrection and other sort of relatively supernatural manifestations of the power of God. The Pharisees were more conservative by contrast, emphasizing obedience to Moses and tended to have more popular support as a result. Because Moses was thought of very highly in Israel. The Pharisees, as a matter of fact, their name drawn from the Hebrew parashah, meaning to separate or separate one. They as a group originated in response to compromising Greek influences in Israel during the intertestamental period, starting to affect Israelite worship. Some of these high priests were adopting Greek practices and Greek ideas and Greek language. And the Pharisees said, whoa, time out. This is not what God commanded through Moses. We've got to preserve some Jewish identity and integrity here. And in that sense, the Pharisees are to be applauded because they were right about this. This is not how God intended the Jews to act. But as you know, if you have read the New Testament at all, the Pharisees devolved into a group of self-righteous hypocrites who conducted themselves in a very external and formalistic fashion, trying to show off how religious they were, rather than be obedient to God out of genuine, heartfelt faith. Right? So this is what creates the conflict between Jesus and the Pharisees, Jesus and John the Baptist, Jesus and the apostles. They did maintain a formal belief in a Messiah and in apocalyptic sort of themes, like Ezekiel's Valley of the Dry Bones and so forth. But those themes received relatively little practice among the Pharisees, who tended to be more occupied with the legalistic minutiae of the Mosaic Covenant, and in addition, stuff they added to Moses that wasn't even really there. Okay? Now, just to give you a taste of this, I've got a quotation here. I won't read you this whole thing, but this is from a book by Alfred Edersheim, called The Life and Times of Jesus the Messiah from 1883. If any of you have a library of good, solid, well-known Christian literature, this book here may be in it, because this book is still in print after over 130 years in existence, and it is a fantastic resource on the life and times of the Jews around the time that Jesus appeared. Here's what Edersheim says. He says, there could be no difficulty in recognizing such a one. Walking behind him, the chances were he would soon halt to say his prescribed prayers. If the fixed time for them had come, he would stop short in the middle of the road, perhaps say one section of them, move on, again say another part, and so on, till whatever else might be doubted, there could be no question of the conspicuousness of his devotions in the marketplace or the corners of streets. All right, does this sound familiar at all? There he would stand, as taught by the traditional law, would draw his feet well together, compose his body and clothes, and bend so low that every vertebra in his back would stand out separate, or at least till the skin over his heart would fall into folds. And he quotes rabbinic authority for that rule. It's actually a rabbinic rule that when you pray, if you really are going to show yourself to be devout, you have to bend over far enough that the skin over your heart folds, you know, over top of itself. Which is, if you think about it, ridiculous. I mean, does Moses ever talk in that fashion? You know, when you pray, you have to bend over such and such a way. And remember, Jesus says about this kind of thing, he spares no condemnation of this sort of thing. He's like, you guys are the blind leading the blind, straining at a gnat to swallow a camel, right? He goes on like that for verse after verse, just whitewashed tombstones, and John the Baptist calls them a brood of vipers and this kind of stuff, because they came up with this sort of stuff that was not in Moses, and they expected the common man or woman to do this sort of stuff, and a lot of the rules they made up they themselves didn't even practice as faithfully as Edersheim makes it sound here. Laying burdens on other men that they were never meant to bear, but you yourself will not lift one finger to to practice them, as Jesus says. So I'm trying to sort of emphasize these guys from a non-New Testament perspective so they fill out the New Testament account, if you know what I mean. All right, now I think I've got a clip coming next, and this gets more into the details of how the scrolls were reconstructed, and then we'll talk more about the group called the Essenes.
It was with the appointment of Emmanuel Tove as editor-in-chief of the Scrolls Publication Project in 1991 that many new scientists have been given a chance to work with the scrolls. As many scrolls have deteriorated quickly since their discovery, scientists struggle to give scholars alternatives to scrolls research while preserving the material for future generations.
Most of the work is really done on photographs. In the 1950s and the beginning of the 60s, superb photographs, infrared, were made of the scrolls, and they are still our best tools. I should add to this that even better ones are being made in these very days.
In labs off the sleek halls at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, Greg Behrman has worked on digital optics used to capture distinct images of the Earth's surface from 5 miles up. Greg hypothesized that multispectral imaging that had been applied to space and planetary optics would be able to push the scrolls beyond the infrared spectrum to reveal more text. Invited by the Israeli Antiquities Authority to Jerusalem, he is going to apply this new technology to fragments that have been selected by scholars from around the world. Selected fragments, darkened by aging and deteriorating rapidly, are put to the test.
I guess this is reverse light.
Behrman's technology is based on using infrared light to capture the lost images. Just as the satellite cameras can reveal stories about life on Earth, he can see beyond the limitations of the naked eye. The situation is tense in the room. Whatever is on the piece of parchment, no one has seen it for almost 2,000 years.
Oh, look at that. That's what you want. Look at that.
In an instant, Greg Behrman washes away 2,000 years of dirt, bat dung, and animal urine, revealing for the first time lines of text that will divulge even more about the suns of light.
Imaging spectroscopy works by taking a lot of different images of the same physical scene at different wavelengths. That information allows you to calculate the spectrum for each pixel in the scene, and then you use spectroscopy, which is a traditional physicist tool, to help you figure out what each pixel is made out of. The way we applied this to the Dead Sea Scrolls was we did exactly that. We took an image every 10 nanometers, starting at 400, 410, 420, worked all the way up to the infrared, and looked at the images as we went along. And what we found out was that as you move further in the infrared, this is 640 and 680, this is the red part, 720, this is infrared. You see that as you move further out, the text begins to emerge from the background. And down here at the bottom is an enhanced version of 970 nanometers.
Images provided by Behrman and his team, today's scholars also have the advantage of replacing the traditional method of scroll scholarship, involving hours of tedious work on fragments or microfiche, with a CD-ROM version of the entire scrolls library on their desktop.
What's on the screen now is column 24 from the Temple Scroll from Cave 11. You'll see the transcription on one side and a photograph of that column on the opposite side. Previously, the scholar had to take this photograph and use either a microscope or a magnifying glass to get a close-up of this particular fragment. Now, a scholar can merely open up the database, select the transcription that he wants, select the area of this fragment, crop it, and then you can get a much closer view of that portion of the fragment.
All right, now, if you're at all exposed to computers or work with computers, that clip there might amuse you a little bit, because it looks like they're working with like Windows 3.1 or something, you know, whatever, Windows 98 or 95, even when they were working on this well, I guess the film was made at the end of the 90s, but what they picture there may even be older than that. But in any case, today you can get access to all the Dead Sea Scrolls online at two main websites. One is maintained by the Israeli Antiquities Authority. That's this site here. Or no, I'm sorry, this is the Israel Museum in Jerusalem. And what you're looking at here, you're seeing a recording of me playing with the great Isaiah scroll. Alright? So this is one of the most famous for Dead Sea Scrolls. You can see the online sort of tools that this website allows you to do. And in a minute, I'll zoom in. And this, we don't have like a high resolution screen here, but if we did, you'd be able to see the creases and the tears in the manuscript as well as if you were looking at the manuscript up close and personal. That's how good the modern tools and online have become. And you don't even need a CD-ROM anymore to get there. If you are interested in this sort of thing, instead of trying to remember that messy URL right there, just Google Great Isaiah Scroll. And this site here will be the first site that comes up. There is a site that that was the Israel Museum. This is the Israel Antiquities Authority site here that is different. Its URL is deadseascrolls.org.il. The .il extension is for Israel. If it didn't have that extension, it would be a U.S. site. But you can see as I scroll down here what exists among the Dead Sea Scrolls. You've got Leviticus. You've got some non-biblical stuff. You've got the Minor Prophets here. You've got something called the Community Rule that we'll get to. But here's the Ten Commandments, and we'll zoom in on the Ten Commandments just so you can see how this manuscript looks. It's not complete. As you can see, it's been torn over here, but you've got a major part of the Ten Commandments out of, I believe this is the Deuteronomy repetition of the Ten Commandments. The Ten Commandments exist here both in Exodus 20 and in Deuteronomy, first part of Deuteronomy. You can see the folds of the bumps and creases in the manuscript. It's really good stuff. All right, I think I'd go down here and maybe look at the Psalms scroll. The Reform Presbyterians love the Psalms, right? So you want to see what the Psalms scroll looks like. And it's a thing of beauty, really. You can even see the creases and the folds all the way down to where the text starts to disappear here. Fantastic stuff. Copies of the Psalms dating before Christ, again, 3rd or 2nd century B.C. Ten Commandments may have been 2nd or 1st century B.C. All of this stuff, somewhere between 300 and the birth of Christ, 300 B.C. and the birth of Christ. Yes. Yeah. And again, you would see it even, you know, if you go home and you've got a reasonably high resolution screen, you'd be amazed at how clear this stuff is. It's really, really good. And you could zoom in down on, you know, if you want to look at a particular letter. Like, I'm not sure if that's this letter or that letter. You can zoom in, and it's as good as if you were looking at the manuscript yourself. And you can imagine what a field day Hebrew scholars and Hebrew Bible scholars have with this stuff. It's just a treasure. All right, another clip coming.
Microbiologist Scott Woodward of Brigham Young University has worked on extracting ancient DNA from mummies in Egypt. Hearing of his work, the Israeli Antiquities Authority approached him regarding DNA sampling of the scrolls.
When we were originally approached by the Antiquities Authority in Israel, the idea was, what can we do with all of these fragments of the scrolls, the pieces that didn't belong in some large scroll? Was there any way that we could put those back together and reconstruct some of the Dead Sea Scrolls from a pile of unconnected fragments?
Because parchment on which the texts are written is leather and comes from animals, the scientists can look for the genetic material found in the cells. Finding small parts of DNA strings in the so-called mitochondria of cells, scientists can create a genetic fingerprint of each individual animal. By testing piece after piece, they can see if they come from the same original parchment, thus likely belonging together in one or the other sequence of text.
Put on the Kelex and we'll go from there.
Okay. Not only can fragments be pieced together, DNA and genetic signatures can reveal even more information.
We have been able to show that the technology works. What that will be able to do for the scholars is help answer the question, where were the scrolls written? In order to do that, we have to take the genetic signature that we now have from some of these scrolls, match it with the genetic signature that we would find from bones from some of the archaeological sites. Bones from Qumran, bones from Jerusalem, and other sites throughout the Holy Land. And then probably finally, the next thing that we ought to be able to do is take some of the unidentified fragments that are still sitting in boxes waiting to be pieced back together to see if we can in fact reconstruct some new pages from which the scholars would then be able to get new information.
So DNA could help reveal if the parchments were actually from Qumran or from somewhere else in the Middle East. The goats had always been prime suspects as the source of scroll material. Common domestic animals, they were a natural fit because they could thrive in the harsh climate of the Dead Sea and were acceptable to use as skin for sacred or biblical text. Ibex skin, a wild animal, was also found in scrolls which were not biblical in nature, but in sectarian documents that were written for the regulation of the community. Ibex was an interesting choice, but not a surprising one. It was with more sampling, however, that the DNA work took an unexpected turn, startling scholars and raising more questions about the scrolls.
But what we found in this case was that these scrolls seem to have been written on parchment from bovine or from cows. There may be a problem with cows here. Where do you raise cows on the shores of the Dead Sea? It's not very easy. I think most people would agree that they probably weren't there. So where did they come from?
All right. Now, the last issue about the bovine manuscript and so forth, bovine parchment, they may really make a bigger deal out of this than it is, because obviously you didn't raise cows on the shores of the Dead Sea. But if you lived on the shores of the Dead Sea and you wanted a bovine parchment, what'd you do? You went to Jerusalem and bought one. You didn't need to raise your own cow, you know. Cows were raised in other places in Israel, and parchments were bought and sold. So they make, you know, this big deal out of, oh no, there's a cow parchment. Where could that have possibly come from? Well, it came from somewhere else in Israel, or maybe even outside Israel, and they were bought and sold in Jerusalem. And Qumran is only a day's walk from Jerusalem. So It's not that big of a deal. Again, one of these issues I told you about that scholars get all exercised and wrapped around the axle about, it's just not really that big of a deal, right? All right. Now, I entitled this first part of the talk, The Dead Sea Scrolls and Apocalyptic Judaism. What do I mean by apocalyptic Judaism? Well, what I mean is a kind of Judaism that is in contrast to the legalistic, Mosaic regulation and external formalism that the Pharisees practiced. What these guys, and a few women as well, and I'll explain in a minute why I say that, why this community is one of the things that distinguishes them so clearly from the Pharisees and Sadducees is that messianic and apocalyptic themes are explicit and pervasive in the Dead Sea Scrolls. What this shows is that these people were interested in writings like Ezekiel and the Valley of the Dry Bones and the passages in Isaiah and Jeremiah that talk about the end of the world. Okay? And more specifically, the appearance of Messiah to save Israel at the end of the world. Do you follow me? They were more observant of Moses and the prophets than the Pharisees without all the accretions that the Pharisees had added. So they were, in a sense, more true to the spirit of Moses and the prophets than the Pharisees and Sadducees were, in many senses, really. The way I convey it is that the authentic spirit of Judaism as conveyed in Moses and the prophets came down to these people at the time of Jesus. And even before, because, I don't have it on this slide, I'll get to it in a minute. Josephus first mentions these guys around 150 BC. That's sort of why we think the Essenes became an active, robust community, at least at Qumran, and probably in the other Dead Sea sites as well, somewhere around 150, which is the same time as an existing letter from the Qumran community to the temple establishment that exists among the Dead Sea Scrolls. These guys wrote a letter to the temple establishment and said, we think what you guys are doing is corrupt. All the Greek stuff you're doing is corrupt. You know, denying resurrection is corrupt. This legalistic minutia around the law of Moses is corrupt. I mean, basically the kind of stuff that Jesus and the apostles said about the temple establishment. These guys are saying similar stuff. And it's sort of, the New Testament gives light on this whole phenomenon. This whole phenomenon gives its own light to the New Testament. The name Essene comes from the Hebrew word hasay, which it means pious. In its Greek form, this leading cha sound is lost, and it becomes Essene, just with the leading e. Okay, that's a common phenomenon in Hebrew language and translation of Hebrew into other languages. Both Philo and Josephus, who are contemporary with Jesus, number the Essenes at about 4,000, maybe above 4,000, throughout Israel. It was a Palestinian movement. There were no Essenes known outside of Israel. But Josephus says they were known in every town of Israel, which is interesting because these guys were largely priests. They came from they were also Levites, like the Sadducees, but they were more working-class Levites, if you know what I mean by that. They did not tend to be the high priests. And they the Levitical priests were assigned to every town and village in Israel, so the Jews had a priest that they could go to, right? And these Levites, in many cases, became Essenes because they read the Old Testament in the way I'm talking about. The kind of authentic, a perspective of genuine faith. And that's one thing to really see in understanding these Essenes is these people were really people of faith. I mean, they believed in God. They believed in Moses as God's representative. They believed in the prophets. That's why they had all the prophets' writings in their library. And they believed in the coming Messiah. In fact, all their hope was placed in the coming Messiah. It's part of the tragedy of what happens to them when the Romans come. They tended to avoid cities because the cities of Israel at the time Jesus appeared were largely corrupt. The priestly leadership, the political leadership, was just not faithful to God. And so, you know, Jesus has confrontations with these people all over the place. And so do the apostles after he's gone. All right, here's a quote from a guy named Emil Schurer, a German scholar from late 19th century, 1890, who wrote a great five-volume work called The History of the Jewish People in the Time of Jesus Christ. Epoch-making kind of work. Here's what he says about the Essenes. All right, this is a lot of words, but if you follow this, it'll be very helpful in understanding these people. Hence, we should be much mistaken if we were, according to Pliny's description, the Roman author Pliny, to seek them only in the desert of En-Gedi on the Dead Sea. The city of En-Gedi is in the Judean desert south of Qumran. And apparently there were a bunch of Essenes there, like there were at Qumran. On the contrary, the settlement there can only have been distinguished above others on account of its numbers. But apparently, Schurer is saying that there's a bunch of Essenes at this location. For the sake of living as a community, they had special houses in which they dwelt together. Their whole community was strictly organized. At the head, they had a president. Whoever desired to enter received three badges, a pickaxe, an apron, and a white garment, which will come in important, become significant here in a minute. So they're simple people. Okay. He was not, however, immediately received into the order, but had first to undergo a probation of 1 year, after which he was admitted to the lustrations, which refers to the initial rites of the group, then followed a further probation of 2 years, and not until this was ended was he allowed to participate in the common meals and to become a full member in taking the oath. A fearful oath, he says. Now he quotes Josephus as saying, the community among them is wonderful. One does not find that one possesses more than another, for it is the law that those who enter deliver up their property to the order so that there is nowhere to be seen either the humiliation of poverty or the superfluity of wealth. But on the contrary, one property for all brethren formed as the collection of the possessions of individuals. So if you follow that, it kind of sounds like the early Christians. Remember the early Christians, they gather in Jerusalem and they hold everything in common and everybody cares for everybody else. And It's not like a communistic sort of thing where nobody believes in private property, but it is an atmosphere of extreme generosity. Like if I had a lot and you're in need, I help you because God owns everything anyway, and so why should you be in poverty while I'm in wealth, right? As long as that's a free transaction between generous individuals, there's nothing communistic or anti-private property about it, right? And in general, in Israel, private property was respected. You can get a whole lot of feel for this in one picture by looking at the Pharisees and Sadducees who tended to dress like this, and the Essenes who tended to dress like this. And I include a picture of a woman here because, this is significant, because the majority of the Essene movement was men. However, there's a cemetery at the Qumran site in which women were buried. Female bodies were uncovered. Which indicates that even though it tends to be men who will say, let's leave civilization and go out and live in the desert together, women tend to be more sane than that, is kind of the way I think about it. You do have men, you know, men are attached to women. They have mothers and sisters and daughters, and some of them are married, so they had wives. But, well, and women are attached to men, and so, you know, people who lived in Qumran would go visit their families who still lived in civilization, and sometimes their families associated women would come out to visit them, and maybe even some women who, like the women around the disciples, Mary Magdalene and Mary the mother of Jesus and some of the very important women in the New Testament, kind of associated with these Essenes in the same way that the early Christian groups and the apostles specifically, who were all men, tended to have female associates. So I put that up there just because in Israel you had both men and women who had this attitude towards God that is innocent and genuine and authentic and faithful and something that God, you know, God honors and calls us to have, calls us all to have. Okay, now, one final clip, and then we'll move to the last couple of minutes.
Another way of asking where the scrolls were written is by studying the clay jars which held them for 2,000 years. Scrolls, jars, and pottery fragments were found in and around Qumran and 11 caves that are adjacent to the site. This wide range of locations leaves the door open to speculation about whether or not the scrolls were made at Qumran. Professor Jan Gunneweg of the Hebrew University is applying the technology of nuclear activation to find out if the jars were made at the community's kiln in Qumran or were perhaps brought there from another location, such as Jerusalem.
In police records all over the world are stored fingerprints of criminals, according to which every individual can be identified. So what we are doing here is the same, more or less the same. We are taking a chemical profile of a kiln, which is called a chemical fingerprint, and we can match it later with the ceramic, which is found at the site.
After gathering clay samples from the kiln at Qumran, Gunneweg goes to the Rockefeller Museum in Jerusalem, where the jars are kept. One interesting characteristic of the scroll jars display is a blistering effect on the ceramic surface. Gunneweg offers several theories to explain the effect. One of the more intriguing is the idea that the jars were made quickly to hide the scrolls, perhaps when the Qumranites learned of the advancing Roman army.
People were in hurry, you know, to produce the jars, and therefore they took whatever they could lay their hands on in order to produce these jars as soon as possible. And therefore when they are going in the kiln, you get different shrinkages, you know, after that they are fired, of the clay and the calcium carbonate, and then you get blisters all over the place. Jar is from cave number 8 in Qumran. What we are going to do is to take a sample of this jar in order to find a match between anything what we have analyzed in Qumran itself end this jar. We have meanwhile already done 30 other jars, so if they match, we can either prove whether it was made in Qumran or it was imported into Qumran.
If DNA analysis takes the scroll research to the molecular level, neutron analysis takes it further into the building blocks of all matter. After the samples are packed in vials, numbered and identified, they are sent to the Technical University of Budapest. Gudovec's partner, Dr. Marta Bala, prepares them for the nuclear reactor. The samples are bombarded by neutrons, which render the powder samples radioactive. The radiation given off by the sample is converted into electric pulses, which are converted into numbers which show the quantities of chemical elements within the clay. This is the fingerprint that will point the way to the location where the jar was made, and a possible clue to the origin of the scrolls themselves. The results from Budapest are sent back to Jerusalem, where they are grouped and compared with tests on other pieces of Qumran pottery in the databank.
And now I have entered in the databank a sample which is one of the 15 storage jars what we have analyzed, and 9 of them are analyzing as a piece of clay what we found in Qumran itself. That means there's not a piece of clay was not imported. Now you find it there. And I have analyzed 3 pieces of clay, which are 3 clay balls. No? They were found as balls, no? About 2 centimeters diameter. And one of them is analyzing as 9 of the 15 storage jars made in Qumran. That means in this case that they really are made in Qumran. They're made from the clay which was found at Qumran. There is another interesting thing, that is that the scroll jars don't analyze exactly the same as all the other pottery. No? So it seems, at least basing ourselves on 30 shirts, that there is a kind of preparation in the clay which is used specifically for the scroll jars, and another composition which is used for the rest of the ceramics.
All right, so you kind of see what they're doing there. They're analyzing the pottery to figure out where it was made and how fast it was made. You heard him talking about this blistering effect where if a pot is made too rapidly, meaning the oven is fired too hot, rather than doing it more slowly over a longer period of time, you get this blistering effect on the outside of the ceramics. And that is found on several of the jars at Qumran, which seems to indicate the storage jars were made in a hurry. Possibly as the Romans were advancing, and these guys were looking for a place and a way to hide their scriptures. Okay? Now, I mentioned this before, among the Dead Sea Scrolls, there's about 200 to 250 biblical manuscripts. There's over 730 documents in Hebrew and Aramaic that are non-biblical, which is a huge number. And what does this contain? Well, the first clip I showed you broke it down pretty well. Besides the biblical scrolls, you have what's known, you know, what's commonly categorized as the literary heritage of the period, including books like the Book of Jubilees, which is a classic non-biblical Hebrew text. You also have a book called Ben Sira, or the Wisdom of Ecclesiasticus, and the Wisdom of Solomon, both of which are in the Roman Catholic Apocrypha, but are not in Protestant and Jewish Bibles. You have a document called the Damascus Document, which seems to relate what these guys did when they fled the site under King Herod the Great, that I talked about earlier. But that site is not sectarian, because it was found at other sites as well. So we know that multiple groups were using this document called the Damascus Document. Now, sectarian scrolls, which refer to the Qumran sect specifically, were found at Qumran and nowhere else, include the community rule, which is their document outlining the rules of the community. If you're going to live in our community, you got to follow these rules, and this is how we treat each other, and we all contribute our property into a common fund, and we all share equally, and all this kind of stuff. There's also ethical stuff in here, like sexual ethics. These guys were very concerned about sexual ethics. There's one of the most famous Dead Sea Scrolls is called the War Scroll, which, I think I said this before, outlines the final apocalyptic battle between the good guys and the bad guys, with Messiah coming to save the good guys. The Temple Scroll lists a bunch of furniture and implements that were used in the temple, a temple of some kind, if it wasn't the second temple that Jesus walked around in and the early Christians walked around in, then it seems to have been a temple that's described in this document that was never built. A temple that is, in fact, enormous in size, as large as the city of Jerusalem. These guys envision like an apocalyptic temple as large as Jerusalem. There's also a document called, and another document that's like it, called The Wiles of the Wicked Woman, which is an interesting sort of instruction from a senior male figure to a junior male figure describing what women do when they try to seduce a man. All right? Now, if you think the first part of Proverbs, like the first 10 chapters of Proverbs, where King Solomon talks about the adulterous woman and she speaks smooth, flattering words, and she stands on the street corner and she beckons in any simpleton that she can deceive with her flattery and stuff, that's the kind of document this is. But it speaks in very Proverbs-like terms, like her household is the household of death, or her way leads to death, like Proverbs says. So it's, like I said, these guys are very concerned about sexual purity. There's also something called the Copper Scroll, which is a very famous Dead Sea Scroll that is written on copper. It's the only scroll that's not written on either parchment or papyrus, which is made from the papyrus reed in more recent manuscripts. The newer the manuscripts are, the more likely they are to be written on papyrus instead of leather, instead of animal skin. Many of these documents are apocalyptic, messianic, angelic. These guys are very concerned about the angels and what the angels do. Very interesting aspect of it. They're also predestinarian. These guys had a theology of predestination that is extremely interesting. They thought that God had called them into the wilderness to make straight the way of the Lord. And that language sounds familiar because that's the way John the Baptist taught, right? And John the Baptist, if the New Testament is to be believed, was appointed by God to do the work that he did. So, this sort of messianic, apocalyptic, angelic, predestinarian aspect of the scrolls comes across pretty well in a couple of them. And I'm going to give you a clip here by the Jewish scholar Schiffman that I referred to earlier in a lecture he gave at UCSB, University of California, Santa Barbara, I believe in the late 1990s. So take a look at this.
There are quite a number of documents from the Qumran sect that speak about messianism. One of them being the scroll of the war of the sons of light against the sons of darkness. There are two points of view regarding messianism and Judaism. One is that the messianic era could be brought about by the slow improvement of the world until God would send his Redeemer. The other one is that there would be a catastrophe because the world was about to blow up. And at that time, God would somehow have to intervene, deus ex machina, and redeem the world before being destroyed. The latter type is what these sectarians believed in. It's the idea of the war of Gog and Magog, or Armageddon, and all this. Now, the idea here is that there would be a war of the sons of light, the sectarians, against first all the other Jews, then all the other nations. After they destroyed everybody, because everybody else is no good, they would come up to Jerusalem to share in the messianic era. Now, most of us probably don't look forward to a messianic era in which everybody else in the world is dead but us. But in case you're bothered by this, I have to tell you something very strange about this text. The author of this text interspersed beautiful poetry between his description of a schematized war. This poetry speaks of the opposite vision. It speaks of all of the nations of the world coming up to God's holy mountain to worship the Lord. It speaks of the Isaianic prophecy of a messianic era in which the whole world shares because everybody truly repents. So either someone had second thoughts, or somehow or another the guy maybe was divulging his true views, maybe we might like to think that. But in any case, this is a fascinating document related to Greco-Roman military manuals, because there's a lot of detail in here about the use of all types of trumpets and swords and military units. Fascinating document. One of the seven original scrolls, by the way, to be found by that Bedouin boy. Now I want to show you some funny things about the problem I was talking about Christianization. You don't have to be Christian, by the way, to Christianize the scrolls. This is a document which is called 4Q Testimonia. It would have been completed had this little piece survived. It's a bunch of biblical verses that support the idea that there will come an eventual redemption. Two Orthodox rabbis in L.A., in the L.A. Times, excuse me, they came from Philadelphia. I don't want to blame L.A. I blame the L.A. Times, but not the city. They announced that this document had the name of Jesus in it, and that they had found the name of Jesus in the scrolls. Needless to say, they got tremendous, tremendous PR. Now, we got to find it right there. Yud, Shin, Vav, Ayin, the same spelling that's on the now broken and now famous ossuary that may or may not be the ossuary of James, the brother of Jesus, where it says, brother of, in Aramaic, Achoy de Yeshua. So they announced, hey, we got the name of Jesus right there. The problem is that these guys obviously did not go to fifth grade in a Jewish day school or teach fifth grade before they were ordained as rabbis. Because in fifth grade, you study the book of Joshua. And in the book of Joshua, it says, as it does here, at that time, right, when Joshua completed praising God, so he then said, this is right after the destruction of the city of Jericho, cursed be the one who will build this city. With his firstborn, he will construct it, and with the life of his secondborn will he put up its gates. So this Yeshua is Yehoshua, Joshua, the biblical Joshua, and there is no Jesus in this text. What can you do? But here is a text which is truly important for the question of Christianity in the scrolls. And this is a document, although it says here Pseudo-Daniel, it's often called Aramaic Apocalypse. And this is a document which, in a section which is not restored, you might not realize it, everything to the right of this line, the light stuff is restored, the dark stuff over here is actual text. And this document actually seems to be referring to a messianic figure. Taking off on Daniel, it has the prophet come before the king, bow down, and tell him a certain prophecy. And then ask the prophet, the king, why is your face so disturbed? Why are you downcast? To that, the prophet, or whoever he is, Daniel apparently, goes on in this apocryphal text, and it's written in Aramaic, which, by the way, there's a rule of thumb in Qumran studies. Aramaic is from 3rd and 2nd centuries BCE. It's not, we don't have time to go into it, but that's the rule of thumb. And this document has a description of what most scholars think is the Messianic era. And in it, there is a figure who is called the Son of God, Bar Elohim in Aramaic, who is the Messiah. This, of course, may lead to the conclusion, I say may because it's one text, that there were some Jews in the pre-Christian era who did term a messianic figure as a Son of God. Needless to say, all kinds of crazy things have been said about this, like that it's about Jesus, which of course is impossible, it was written in the 3rd century B.C. That it either proves or disproves. See, all that kind of nonsense comes in. But this is a text which does seem to give us an indication of what may have been a possible messianic designation at that time.
All right. This is a very rich clip. There's a lot in here we could talk about. And there's some good and some bad, really, because I don't think Schiffman is entirely fair when he's talking about the war scroll and he says the guy seems to change his mind and he shows his real opinions because he alternates between a vision of doom when God destroys his enemies and then a vision when all the nations go up to Jerusalem to worship the king. Well, all the war scroll is doing there is emulating the prophets. Prophets do that all the time. Why? Because think of the book of Revelation. At the end of the book of Revelation, Jesus Christ appears on a white horse, completely slays his enemies in a very graphic, military sort of vision. Now, whatever that means, it's a doom and gloom kind of thing for whoever's on the receiving end of that judgment. However, what does the book of Revelation then say? It says, people from every tribe, tongue, and nation go up to Jerusalem to worship the King. Why? Right? Because there really is, at the end of time, a war between the sons of light and daughters of light, and the sons of darkness and the daughters of darkness, and God is going to come and rid the earth of all wickedness and everyone who practices it. So this is, and all the prophets line up with that same vision, and so does the war scroll. So he's really flippant when he says, it's all about just, killing everybody but us. Well, it's not quite that sort of us against them and we're good and they're evil. It's the fact that there really is evil in the world, and there really are people who practice it, and if they persist in that to the end, they're going to have God to reckon with, right? The idea of a final judgment. So that is a very biblical idea that comes across in these scrolls that Shipman doesn't seem to grasp, which surprises me because he's, in many things, he's a very solid scholar. He is correct, however, when he says that 4Q Testimonia, that one script he put up there, does not contain the name of Jesus. I've heard people discuss that, particularly in Christian circles, where they think, since these things existed and some were composed at the time of Jesus, maybe they did recognize and mention Jesus. But they don't. They just don't. That quotation he talked about, in which the two rabbis claimed it was a reference to Jesus, is a verbatim quotation of Joshua 6:26, which Joshua utters after he destroys Jericho. He utters a curse, and he says, whoever rebuilds this city will pay for it with his children, basically. The other document that Shipman talks about, the Aramaic Apocalypse, is often called the Pierced Messiah Scroll, because this figure that is called the Son of God, which is very, very significant, was interpreted by two guys named Eisenman and Wise in the early 1990s. Eisenman and Wise published many of the scrolls that had remained unpublished for 30 years, and so they got a lot of prestige and credit in the community of scroll scholarship, but they made some really poor interpretations of, in this case, what is clearly a triumphant messianic passage to make it sound like the Messiah is suffering. He's being pierced, like the book of Zechariah talks about. The book of Zechariah talks about how the Jews will look upon him whom they pierced. Very tantalizing, really haunting kind of prophecy if you're thinking about Jesus and how Jesus was crucified, right? The use of the Son of God is significant because today, you hear someone use the term Son of God, you almost certainly know that they're either a Christian or they're talking about Christians and Christianity, because that is almost exclusively a Christian term, Son of God. It is used in the Old Testament, however, most prominently in Psalm 2, where the Lord says, "You are my Son, today I have begotten you. Ask of me and I shall give you the nations for your inheritance." That's the Messiah being called the Son of God. And Jesus will adopt that term for himself, Son of God, in several places in the New Testament. And the authors of the New Testament will attribute that term to Jesus in many places, making clear that he is the one referred to in Psalm 2. But the fact that these Jews, these Essenes, did not believe in Jesus, but still used the term Son of God, shows that this idea of the Son of God as a Jewish concept predated the rise of Christianity. And that's the point Shipman's making here. And it is only one scroll, and there's not any others that refer to the Messiah as the Son of God that I know of. But it shows sort of a conception of the Messiah as not being merely a great man, a great human, but actually being, in some sense, from God. All right? Now, this point about the Messiah not being pierced and not suffering, there is no concept in the Dead Sea Scrolls of a suffering Messiah. Very important point that will come up again in the second half of this presentation. The scrolls are nationalistic and triumphalistic almost exclusively. They envision a restored Israel, the kingdom restored to Israel, the Messiah, the Son of David, possibly also the Son of God, now present ruling Israel, and Israel redeemed among the nations, so to speak, no longer under the rule of the Romans. Okay? So, a lot of this we today associate almost exclusively with Christianity, and rightly so, because the Jews don't tend to talk about the Son of God, even when they're thinking about the Messiah. Really, only Christians do that. Okay? All right, so the conclusion to this half, and then we're going to take a 10-minute break and get some refreshments, and then we'll come back and talk some more. The Essenes were devout, apocalyptic, messianic Jews in every town and village of Israel, but concentrated in the Judean deserts, especially after 150 B.C., who believed that Israel and the temple establishment were corrupt. Pliny calls them gens eterna in the Latin, which means like eternal people or eternal generation, seeming to indicate that they've been around a long time in Israel, which is interesting because they're really concentrated after 150 B.C. But remember, they're also priests, and the Levitical priesthood had been around a long time. And anywhere you've got a seriously devout Levitical priest, you've got someone who looks an awful lot like an Essene, even if it's back, many centuries before. Their organizing communities in the Judean desert appears to have started around 200-150 B.C., when they finally said, this temple we can't deal with, we gotta withdraw. I interpret it as one of the many signs and wonders preceding the appearance of Christ, and as we'll get to in the second lecture, talking about, or at least influencing the production of John the Baptist and the disciples. I mentioned Simon the Zealot. There's also a case to be made that Jesus' disciple Andrew, who's the brother of Simon Peter, was at least influenced by John the Baptist and possibly by these groups of Essenes before they became Christians. Okay? B.B. Warfield, great Princeton theologian, Presbyterian, 19th century, said famously, when our Lord came down to earth, he drew heaven with him. He's talking about the miraculous signs and the appearance of angels and prophecies and these sorts of things that came with Jesus when he came. These sorts of extra-biblical phenomena, like the groups of apocalyptic messianic Jews organizing themselves in the Judean desert right about the time that Jesus appears, are very interesting in terms of that larger perspective of the appearance of Jesus and all the strange and phenomenal things that happened. Remember, John says at the end of his gospel that if everything Jesus had done and said were recorded, all the world could not contain the books that would be written, right? So that means that there's a lot of stuff, people, later Christians, that happened here that we just don't have the space in this manuscript to record, because we're trying to be somewhat concise. But you need to understand how terrific and phenomenal this man was, why we believe him to be the true Son of God on the previous slide, and indeed the Messiah that was promised to Israel. All right, so with that, we'll take a break, unless Bill has other ideas, and then we'll do sort of a discussion in Q&A after the second half. And so hopefully you can stick around for that part of the presentation as well. Thank you very much. You've been fantastic so far.
There'll be some refreshments, something to drink. You can go to the bathroom if you need to. I'll call you back together in about 10 minutes.
So you want to just spread it out on the table back there?
Yeah.
Yeah. How you doing, man?
Good.
Hey, Emmett.
Emmett?
Yeah.